Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM in your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And talk about positively minded, I have in the studio with me my dear friend and associate, Dr. William Peter Atwood. Hi, Bill. Thanks for being back with us.
Hi there, Armand. It's good to be back.
And also on air with us, and an issue that we have to look at, is an author, B. Hibbs, Dr. B. Janet Hibbs, who is, B. wrote a book. I mean, she's a you're a clinical psychologist, aren't you, B.? Welcome to BAI.
Hi, thank you. I'm a clinical psychologist, and I'm also a marriage and family therapist.
Right, that's what Bill is as well, who's, who's sitting with us. It's two of you I thought would be good for this.
Mm-hmm.
This whole idea of practical steps for negotiating fairness in relationships.
Right.
Fairness. I mean, what is fairness? What does that mean? What's that about?
Well, intuitively, we all believe we know what's fair, and actually that gets us in trouble. Because while we all have a gut feeling, a strong moral sense about some of the basics of fairness, like it's not good to lie, cheat, or steal, that's not all there is to fairness. You know, that's our gut feeling. But there's a second realm of fairness that my book is about that really talks about the learned aspect of fairness that we learn like we learn our first language. We learn it in our families growing up. And that's what we bring to our relationships and marriage. And so we're going to bring a different sense of fairness than our partner brings because we grew up in different families.
Right. So there's a sense of fairness. I mean, when I think about fairness and marriage and family counseling, part of the reason why I never really wanted to do it is that I always felt like you were negotiating.
Right.
You know, if you take off your shoes when you come in the house, and then if you don't put anything on the coffee table, then I'll have sex with you.
Right.
And that's, you know, and that's, is that about fairness?
Well, that's the opposite of what I think of as fairness. That's
good for you.
That's a quid pro quo negotiation. That's tit for tat. When you don't trust that another person will be fair to you, you actually do that kind of, you know, nitty-gritty negotiation of I'll only do this if you do that. It's very conditional. And so that's not fairness. That's what people resort to when they don't know how to be fair.
Okay, so we're talking, just to let you know, with the author, B. Hibbs, B. Janet Hibbs, Dr. B. Janet Hibbs, who wrote a book, Try to See It My Way, about fairness. Now, this is a very interesting concept of fairness. So the quid pro quo is not what fairness is about. And then you said this other big thing, of course, and it's probably the primary theme of my work. It's about trust.
It is about trust. Right. And you have to earn trust. And
what do you mean earn trust?
There are actions that build trust. And so if we feel fairly treated, then we trust another person. And when we don't feel fairly treated, we're motivated by all kinds of things. We're motivated by revenge. We're motivated to harm. So that's how people find themselves doing destructive things that, you know, objectively they wouldn't even agree with.
Well, B, are you saying that you think, and I do, by the way, I believe that most people are kind of just by nature of being human, you're somewhat damaged. You know, you come out of childhood,
right,
and you're trying to find out, you find this little trust door, and you get hurt, and you close the door.
Right.
Now, you're saying something that I think you're saying something that I agree with deeply, that door has to be negotiated, that door is going to stay closed unless the person gets to feel that you're really safe to let them in.
That's true. And then there's a notion of in any long-term relationship, and so now we're talking a committed relationship or a marriage, in any long-term relationship, you're going to hurt the other person. Not because you intend to, but because you're different.
Just because you step on their toe.
Because you don't understand how you're different, even. So you are going to do something that damages the trust eventually, not because you want to, not doesn't have with whether you love them. And then you have to find ways to repair it. And you also have to define the meaning, the unique meaning of what's fair to each person.
Hmm.
Yeah, well, I was struck by you talking about bringing different sense or a different concept of fairness from your family experience, because fairness very often is a hot-button issue for everyone all through their life, because we often experience our parents and our family setting as unfair. So that, combined with the fact that you have two different sets of fairness coming into contact with each other, I think that it is really a very good point.
It's, you know, one of the things that I talk about in the book, while the book is primarily about love and marriage relationships, I take a chapter to talk about what happens with unmet needs from childhood, which I call the baggage we all bring. How what are the long-term consequences, and then how do you heal it? So I don't want people just to think, oh my gosh, you know, I grew up in this or that family, all is doomed. I think, no, it's like you have a choice. You can become conscious of the consequences of unfair, unmet needs growing up, and then you can not burden your marriage, not burden your partner with your childhood issues.
How do you not burden your partner with your childhood issues? How do you distinguish them? I mean, it's so hard to be able to tell which is which.
That's true. I often think of marriage as two tribes who have come together to fight over who's right and what's fair. Because people have such wildly different ideas sometimes about what is fair in day-to-day life.
You know, I often think of people who come in for couples counseling as people who are trying to say, would you tell him that he's wrong?
That often is what happens.
Would you tell her she's wrong? We want you to just pick a side.
I think that's what everyone hopes when they come in, is that you'll give them a psychological dispensation to say, you're guilt-free, you know, you're fine and the other person's offbeat. But the reality is that there are multiple facets to fairness, and that everybody has a hold on it, but then you have to figure out, like, how reasonable and how realistic is what your needs are, have you earned the right from your partner to get your needs met, or are you asking them to compensate for...
Right, that's too much right there. We've got to break into that a little bit.
Let's,
by the way, it is Janet Hibbs. Oops, I'm sorry, it's B. Hibbs.
That's fine, it's both.
Let's go into that a little bit. Are you asking them to compensate?
Right.
Everybody I know who's in a relationship is asking their mate to compensate for the damages of childhood. I've never seen it any different in one form or another. Please give me fill in the missing pieces. Fill in the missing pieces of my childhood. Filling the missing pieces of myself. How can you distinguish? How could you separate the two out? The mirror won't even let you look and see.
I think that's actually one of the reasons that I wrote this, because I wanted couples to have a framework where they could understand, what are my issues, what are your issues, how do we figure it out? Because a lot of issues come up in day-to-day life, whether it's money, children, chores, or sex, but in-laws, they pretty much all boil down to what's fair and how do people figure it out, and what unfinished business are we bringing that isn't fair to put onto any relationship. You know, whether we stay in this one or go to the next one, hey, we're going to take our issues with us.
Can you give me a step-by-step of how you would do that? How would you be able to identify?
Okay. So first, what I would ask couples to do is I would first ask them to look at kind of their blind spots and their assumptions about, you know, fairness. And so I might ask them to look at things like whether they think that love conquers all, or if you love me enough, you'd know what I need without my having to ask you. Or since I'm a good person, you know, my take on fairness must be right. Or good people don't put their needs first. So, you know,
bring that back a little bit for me?
Okay.
If we were to ask people in the audience these questions, we would ask the audience, we would say to them right now, ask yourself this question. Do you believe?
Mm-hmm.
And let's go over those again. You know, do you believe that love conquers all? Do you believe that if there is a conflict between the two of you, that there should be some level of love that is going to be greater than whatever the conflict is, therefore the conflict is meaningless? Is that what you're asking?
No. So let me go back.
Sure.
All right. So in The Love Conquers All, I think people often do think that if you loved me, you would meet my needs and you would even know what I need. So I'm saying, okay, that's just a misconception.
That's an amazing thing, because I saw just an incident of that today where someone said, how could you be so insensitive?
Right.
It was a woman said, I want to see photographs of your old girlfriend. So he said, okay, here are the pictures of my old girlfriend. And she said, that's great, thank you very much. And then he sent one picture with his old girlfriend, but his hand was in the picture. And she said, how could you be so insensitive as to send me a picture with your hand in it? And he said, but you were asking me to send you pictures.
Right.
And they just completely fell apart over that, probably
right.
with other things going on.
Right.
Well, I think one of the biggest issues in working with couples is how to get past this point of you're responsible for making me feel good.
That's a really important one. I absolutely agree with you.
That's Dr. William Peter Aswood, Bill Aswood with us as well. You're responsible for making me feel good. If I don't feel good, you got to do something to make me feel good. Is that a common demand?
I think that's a common demand, and it gets people into a lot of trouble. And it's partly, and what happens with it, and so here's one of the tips I would give people. If you go down that road, what you're going to do is you're going to complain about your partner. And what's more constructive and what's fairer to do is to say, here's what I'm asking for. Here's what, you know, if you could do X, that would be, you know, so much better for me. So make a claim on your partner rather than complain or blame. That would be one thing that would just...
Okay, so walk me through that step again. Make a claim rather than blame.
Right.
Let's say that again. If you would do this, I would feel better?
Right, right. This would, you know, this would help me, or this is even why I need, you know, you to do something. Tell the person what the meaning it has for you instead of just saying, why don't you do this, or how could you have done that? You know, complaining doesn't get you anywhere.
And accusing doesn't get anywhere either.
Accusing doesn't get you anywhere.
You point the finger, the person automatically gets defensive.
Exactly.
Okay, so let's say you find one way, we take blame and we throw it out the window.
Okay.
But if we don't have blame, then where are you going to go with your irrational anger when you feel it? When sometimes you just wake up, and for whatever reason, whether it be a cycle of the moon or whatever you ate, you're in a mood where you feel like picking a fight.
Okay.
And you go to your mate and you say, I want to rip your head off today because you sent me a picture with your hand in it. And the guy says, but, what do you do?
So what do I do if I'm the guy or if I'm the girl?
You're the guy.
I'm irrational.
If you're the guy. Or have you ever felt those kind of irrational feelings?
Well, I guess I would have a different answer to each person. To the person, to the woman who's being irrational, I would ask her to really slow down and to say, what is she asking for? Because behind, you know, really what she's saying is, now I feel threatened and vulnerable. But instead of saying, now I feel threatened and vulnerable, she's simply blaming her partner. And that's unfair. So, I mean, there's lots of communication things that are unfair, and that's one thing that people, just as a baseline, have to change. And also they have to change her, she has a certainty, like an absolute certainty, almost like a moral certainty that she's right. And people, that is the biggest misconception that people have to change, is to recognize right is kind of between two people. And sometimes, you know, it's a 60-40 split, or sometimes it's a 20-80 split in terms of, well, what would an objective outsider say? But when you get angry, my first suggestion to people is get calm enough to try to understand the other person's perspective. Give them a benign explanation if you can.
But you've been to that place, B, where, you know, where that none of that makes sense. if you're carried away with yourself, I've been there where suddenly, for whatever reason, whether it be sleep or because I had to take steroids or because of something, at those moments, or if you're in some kind of a rage because of some mood thing going on, you can't say to yourself, oh, I'm rageful, therefore I should slow down.
Well, okay, so then let me talk with you about this. Sometimes you're right. Our lizard brain takes over. That part of our brain that's just fear and rage, it just takes over. But hopefully you know yourself well enough to know after the fact, oh, that was my lizard brain talking. Now I've got to, now I really have to own up to it because that's only fair. I have to own up to it if I've done damage. And I have to acknowledge that I've done damage. And I have to work harder not to do that in the future.
B, do me a favor. Tell me in your own life.
Yeah.
Have you had the experience where you saw your lizard brain take over and then you came back to undo it?
I have, although, you know, because I've been doing this so long and I do this with couples, I've pretty well trained myself. But sure, like everybody has
You keep your lizard quelled.
I recognize it when it pops up and I go, all right, I'm not going to say anything right now because it would just be destructive.
And so now this is a very important thing. Is there a way to distinguish lizard brain from what seems to be rational demand? I guess it's the intensity of the feeling. How? What do you think, Bill?
This is the perennial question. Basically, people come to therapy because of how they feel. And the major, to me, the task of the therapist is to operationalize feelings, to convert them into, well, what behaviors are these related to? And I think that's what B is doing. She's come up with her own particular way of saying, okay, you feel, it's good to feel, this is how you feel. What does this have to do with behavior? What does this have to do with how you act and interact with your husband or your wife? Because you can't and shouldn't have to change your feelings. And you can't change your feelings. You feel what you feel. But you can change what you do. And how you feel is altered by what you do.
Good point. What do you think of that, Bea?
I think that was really well put. Thank you for having a very succinct way of describing that for the audience.
He's a smart man.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it. You do have a choice about what you do. Yeah, you may not have a choice about what you feel in any given moment.
Okay. Yes, and therapy is educating people or is helping people to educate their sense of what they can do.
Right.
It gives them a quiver full of arrows to deal with various situations rather than being stuck with one blunt club.
Right, exactly. And so to go back to your example about
the picture with the hand.
The picture with the hand. All right, so it goes back to, you know, if you were going to say, how would she, like, break this apart? First of all, the guy. I hope the guy would say to himself, whoa, is this her issue? I'm not getting into the content now. I'm just going to say, honey, you need to get to a calmer spot, and then we'll talk about it. Because, like,
well, you see, no, it doesn't happen that way. You see, it sneaks up on you. It comes up, you know, I'm curious as to why you sent me this one photograph. It doesn't come up with a blow-up at first.
Uh-huh.
It usually is putting the twigs over the hole, you know, and then you put the grass over the twigs, and then you step into it, and then suddenly you're in the bottom of the hole.
Okay.
Now, this is not just men. Men do the same thing to women. Women do this to men.
Okay.
It looks benign. It looks okay. It looks like a simple, nice conversation.
Right.
Then all of a sudden you're in the bottom of the hole, and you're fighting your way out, and you're like in a courtroom because, and I tried, and I can't. And that's where you get caught. Never. It's really, the beginning is easy. If somebody's rageful at the beginning, that's a breeze.
Right. Okay.
So when you're in the middle of it, when you get caught in the middle of the trap, that's when you got to step back. That's when you have to get that thing. But it's almost impossible because as you try to step away, that other person's coming after you.
You've described a really great dynamic. I mean, you described really well, an unfortunate dynamic that happens between people when both, you know, when they are kind of caught unaware, kind of a deer in the headlights, and they can't undo. Part of it is that the guy is not going to be able to help her because he didn't create, he pushed a button, but he didn't install it. And so it goes back to your question of how do you know what's reasonable? You know, how do you know what's rageful versus what's reasonable to be mad about? And I guess part of what I would say is everybody brings a model of fairness about what they should expect, what a partner should do, what they deserve. They bring that to their marriage and to their committed relationships. And unless you really slow down and evaluate all those shoulds, the model that builds up those shoulds, which you do learn as a kid, then you are just going to act it out rather than understand it's just a model.
My guest is Bea Hibbs. Dr. Bea Hibbs wrote a book called Try to See It My Way, which just came out this week, which is about the fairness of it. You know, Bea, as you think about it, and I'm sure, Bill, you'll agree with me, it's very sad the way people live with each other after a while. After a while, you learn to stonewall the other person, tune them out, overpower them, threaten them. And most couples that I've seen in life, most people walking around in supposedly happy marriages, are terrified, and they just wind up keeping this thing going by, you know, doing these maladaptive or these adaptive behaviors where you wind up just in your own mind saying, you know, well, they're crazy, so I'm not going to deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates a greater and greater distance. And I know so many people who live in these kind of boring, horribly dead marriages because they don't want to take it on. And it takes such a skill and such a dedication to say, I don't want to just die together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's so hard to reach out. And most people don't have therapy available to them. Most people in this world are just trying to get through.
I know one of the things that I often say to the people that I work with is that marriage is the only complex human behavior that people expect to get worse at the longer they do it.
But we can get better at it.
Yep.
You talk about your survival kit, step one,
mm-hmm.
recognizing the injustice. Let's talk about recognizing the injustice.
Okay. In order for things to get better, so going from, marriage being something we can get worse at, well, in order for it to get better, you have to learn how to repair an injury. You have to learn, like, however it happened, you know, whether it was, you know, even if it was unintentional, you know, you have to recognize, and sometimes it's going to be brought to your attention rather than a light bulb going off and going, oh, my gosh, like, now I see why, you know, I really upset my husband or my wife. Usually it's going to be the other person going, hi, you know, why'd you do such and thus? But one of the parts of healing is really owning up to it, not just defending yourself, not just saying, oh, well, you just didn't understand. It's owning up to saying, yeah, I did that. I really have to figure out why I did that. I really owe you an apology. It's owning up to your own behavior.
But, you know, apologies become very facile. They become very easy after a while. I'm sorry. You know, I can't tell you the number of people I've seen who have come in where the one person says to the other, I'm sick of hearing how sorry you are.
And so
you'll just do it all over again.
My response to that is that there's what I would call a sham apology, which is saying all the right words, but without any comprehension of why you did what you did. And without really understanding even why it was meaningful to the other person. So part of what you owe a person are not just the polite scripted words. You owe it to them to take a harder look at what the heck was going on for me that I did that.
I know, gitnip is one of the words that we invented here. GITNIP. It means good in theory, not in practice.
Okay.
Now, this sounds like a gitnip, because I give you this example. Give me a type A personality who's a bull in a china shop.
Mm-hmm.
He goes home, he has a sensitive wife.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He goes home, and by accident, he kind of says something off his hand. He's the frustrations of his day, and he does something that hurts her feelings.
Mm-hmm.
He comes home late. He does something wrong over and over and over again. It reminds me of the joke, if a man is alone in the woods, can he still be wrong? You know what I mean? So he's wrong over and over and over again, and he really sees himself like a bull in the china shop, and he realizes he broke something, and he looks, he says, oh, honey, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. I didn't mean to do that. But he's sincere in his apology.
Mm-hmm.
He's just caught in his own personality.
And so part of what I would say is, well, then it all kind of depends on the ratio. You know, so if he does five good deeds, and then he is a bull in the china shop once, then the five good deeds, you know, it's kind of like the seesaw of reciprocity. If the give and take is balanced enough, then you have a buffer against those china shop moments. But if the reciprocity isn't balanced and isn't balanced over time, then there is no buffer, and then you're in a power struggle.
So therefore, what you're saying is when there is an overreaction to the bull breaking something, when you have an overreaction that's so severe, you haven't had enough of the solid stuff
right
to make that work in. So it merely is an indication when a person in, when a person is deeply wounded
yeah.
by someone else's errant behavior,
mm-hmm.
right? Even yeah. if it's, you know, aggressive stuff,
mm-hmm.
the overreaction may be a reflection that this person needs more. And it may not be that they need more from you, the husband or wife. They may need more in their lives. This could be a sensitivity of theirs. It's very complex.
You know, there's a past and a present contribution to almost every marital interaction. So there's the buttons that somebody else installed and your partner pushes. And then there's a history between partners. If you've been together long enough, to go back to Bill's comment about marriage is a thing that you can, you know, with practice get worse at, that then there's a history between partners. So there get to be sore spots in marriage. There get to be the hot buttons you bring, and then there's sore spots that develop over time. And again, it's partly, is there enough balance of good? Is there enough care? Is there enough consideration? Is there a seesaw between give and take that feels good to both people and feels, okay, that's fair, you know, and so I have, you know, if you drained trust one day because you were that bull in the china shop, did you feel it back the next day?
And this is a, what we're going to have to ask you for is some kind of a template that people might use that comes from your work.
Mm-hmm.
And but the work, by the way, is called Try to See It My Way, a new book about being fair in love and marriage by B. Janet Hibbs. What I'm going to ask you to do, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back from the break, I'm going to really ask you to step it out, that if you had our beautiful listening audience who were sitting there with each other, and they're saying, boy, if only we could do some of these things with each other, mm-hmm. maybe you can spell out for us, for the group of people listening, here is step one. Here's what I want you to do. This is the first step. I would like you to sit down and do this.
Okay.
Not immediately. We're going to do this just in about a minute.
Okay.
And you know, step two, I want you to try to pursue it from this place. Because I think you've done a lot of work on this for many years. You've been a therapist, and it must have taken a lot of organizations to just put the book together to kind of get your ideas together.
Mm-hmm.
And people love things that they could try. They want to be able to do things on their own.
Yep.
So there's... So what I'm going to ask you for is some kind of step-by-step that gives us something that people could do, maybe an exercise that they could do, maybe questions they could ask ourselves.
Okay.
All right. And this is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. Again, my guest is B. Janet Hibbs. My co-host today is Dr. William Peter Astwood. We're going to be back with you in just a couple of minutes. Stay with us, my friend, as we go to some station identification.
Hi, this is Lloyd Price, and you're tuned to WBAI New York. Listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
Okay.
Oh, now, Lord, 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 Miss Gordon.
All right. And this is Armand DeMille back with you with The Positive Mind. William Peter Aswood, B. Janet Hibbs. And B has given us some tips. If you're in a relationship, maybe here's a way that you could up the ante a little bit. You know, maybe you could get yourself out of those leopard skin, no, those lizard skins. Right. Go ahead, Janet. So what would you suggest that people do to kind of examine and maybe up the quality of their relationship?
Okay. So there's a few different exercises, and there's questionnaires in Try to See It My Way. But let me give people an exercise. I want you to think about the last stupid fight you had. And I say stupid because most people will every now and then say, I can't believe we were fighting over something this stupid. It's like an endless marital argument, one that just repeats itself over and over again. And one of the things that you need to do is think about, okay, what grade would you give yourself in your effort to sort out why you're having this conflict? And what grade would you give your partner? So if you had to grade yourself A, B, C, D, F, what grade would you give yourself? What grade would you give each other? And then do...
Stop right there. That's a beautiful thing. Okay. I love the idea. Let me think about the last argument I was having with somebody I cared about. What grade would I give myself? Oh, well, I give myself an A. And I give them... well, actually, of course, when you're asking yourself to grade yourself, if you're really being honest with yourself, you know... Yeah. Your A-level functioning. You know the A-plus in you, and you know the D in you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So that's great. That's great. If you're asking yourself the question, not asking your... Because you don't want to tell your mate that you were wrong.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Okay, so good. So you ask yourself, what grade would I give myself? And then you look at your mate, and you say, okay, how would I grade there? And basically what you're saying... Is their insight, they're taking responsibility for themselves.
Correct.
Their lack of blaming.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Their integrity.
Yes.
Is how, basically it.
Right. How would they, you know, and how would you really take responsibility for, did you validate your partner's experience? Did you talk about any extra charge you were adding? You know, did you... You know, were you curious about your partner's experience, or did you just want to fight to win? So that would be one exercise. You know, another might be...
Well, but let's take that okay. a step further. If you graded yourself...
Yeah.
And you saw yourself, well, you know, I really didn't do very well. Now comes one of those apologies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the apologies sometimes are a mistake.
Yeah.
I think it's one that says to yourself, you say to yourself, I would like to function better.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to function at a higher level.
Mm-hmm.
I would like not to get triggered into this person's passions when they appear.
Right.
I would like to be able to love them even if they're screaming at me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would like to. And yeah. for those, I would give myself better grades.
Yes.
But sometimes I can't because I have a lizard brain too.
Right.
And my lizard brain always functions at D, you know?
Right. And then you'd say to yourself, well, let me try to think of what's my goal. Because my goal isn't to be in lizard brain where I'm just going to rant and rave because that doesn't get me anywhere. What's my goal? Is my goal to, you know, identify and let my partner know what actually would be a step that would help me? A small everyday change or maybe a huge change. You know, did I do that in a constructive way? What's my goal? Because we could learn to resist destructive impulses that come from our lizard brains if our goal is to be fairer.
So being fair goes back to your being fair. Is the goal that I want to be fair, meaning, is the goal that I want to have a shared... loving, tender, cooperative experience with this partner of mine? Do I want to get closer?
Right.
Because, you know, the danger here is that for many people, it threatens you with a level of intimacy that you're not familiar with, a vulnerability that you're not familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you have to be willing to face that as well.
I certainly think that's, you know, it feels more powerful to be angry than it does to be vulnerable and to ask for something for yourself. And so it is a risk. You know, you're taking a risk by letting go of a blaming position. You're taking a risk saying, here's what would be fair to me. But I come to think that, you know, given the two choices, you stand a better chance of getting what you want by letting the other person know what really would be fair to you. So I could give you another exercise, or
we will in a minute. We'll have the question.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that one of the advantages of being a couples therapist is that there is at least the possibility, if a couple comes to see you, mm-hmm. that they are willing to expand the level of intimacy that they can tolerate. And if you can begin to give them the tools, and this is basically what this book is about, is a set of tools.
Right.
Hopefully, slowly but surely, they will expand their capacity to take those kinds of risks
mm-hmm.
that will increase the intimacy. But it is a difficult thing.
I tell you, you know, lizard brain is a very active, dynamic way of living, but it keeps you on edge all the time. The non-lizard brain really is a voyage. It takes you into space. It's an amazing place. But it's most people will never know it. Certainly most of our parents never knew it, you know? What it's like to really be functioning at the highest possible level with each other. Which does not mean denial. Which doesn't mean shutting off your feelings.
Mm-hmm.
But it's this dedication to the concept of fairness. Let me hear another one of the exercises.
Okay, so another exercise would be practicing letting go of the supreme advantage of only having your story running through your playback loop. So a lot of times we rehearse and we practice, you know, why I'm right and why, you know, why the other person's wrong. And so instead of, like, just keeping this monologue going, to really practice, you know, because it's an obstacle to fairness. You're just saying, okay, I'm going to catalog all my wrongs. I'm going to tally them up. And it leads to a one-sided perspective that's very susceptible to blaming the other person. It's kind of like, oh, there's only one truth. So another exercise is to say, well, what would an outsider say? So there's my story, your story, and then what would an outsider say?
And what if the outsider was my mother?
Well,
that's different. You got to leave that out, right?
Yeah.
You know what my mother would say? No. What do you mean by what would an outsider say? If I could step outside of myself.
Right.
Is that what you're saying?
If you could say, let's write down three parts to the story. Let's write down my side. Let's write down your side, and then let's write down another version of the story that incorporates your side and my side in a balanced way. What would that third way be?
And I don't exactly understand who would do that.
You each would do that. You each as a partner would say, all right, I'm going to make an effort. You know, it's like if you want somebody to see it your way, they want just as much, you know, for you to see it their way.
Boy, that's pretty high-level functioning that you're asking of people. You know, it sounds like people have had to gone through 7 years of analysis and 14 years of primal therapy to get to that point.
Actually, what I find, because I'm extremely direct with people, and I tell them when they're wrong and they're off base and their thinking's distorted, and I tell them up front, like, you owe it to her, let's say, to look at this way, you know, or you owe it to him. This is you're off base here. And so part of what people often do need is that they need somebody who's an advocate for the relationship working better because it has become fairer and that people are willing to be fair rather than just, you know, fight to win.
Yeah, well, I was actually thinking, as you were talking about, you know, the third party, what would their opinion be, that's you, the therapist.
It's often the therapist, unless you really have a friend to the marriage who really, really cares about the marriage. But you can have people assume the position of third party by saying, okay, well, let me try to write my partner's perspective now.
Right.
You know,
instead of just mine.
Maybe it might be better if I were standing in outer space looking down at us.
Mm-hmm.
How would I, if I were a shrink from outer space, how would I see us right now? Because you know the trouble with friends and outside people, and even therapists take sides. They do take sides.
Right.
You know, I mean, the therapist is always favoring one over the other.
Mm-hmm.
If the therapist can't get along with hysterical people, he's always against the hysteria. If he can't, if he or she can't get along with somebody who's too logical, they're always saying you don't feel enough.
Right.
It's like they have their own prejudice, too.
That's true.
So you really got to fall back on yourself or find a therapist like you or Bill Astwood who can have that kind of objectivity to kind of stand back and be what you're talking about, which is an advocate for the relationship.
Correct.
Now, I like relationship advocates. I think that's even better than couples therapist. You know?
Yeah. Well, it's a new phrase. We'll use that phrase.
Okay, you can have it.
Okay.
I like the shrink from outer space.
So Janet, let's see another one of your tools that you might use with people. Well, I wanted to ask you about the questionnaire, by the way.
Okay.
In the questionnaire, what are you looking for?
I'm looking for people to be able to, if they imagine themselves on a seesaw where on one end they were a giver and on another end they were the receiver. So give and take. What I'm looking for is for them to identify. I actually break the questionnaire down into four parts. You know, you and your partner now, you and your mom and dad growing up, you and your kids. And then just in general, do you more often find yourself on the giving end, on the receiving end of that seesaw? How do you feel about being on one end or another? Does it seem fair that you're on one end or another? Do you get back what you're looking to get back? So I sometimes have people draw themselves on the seesaw and say, who's the giver, who's the taker, and how does the balance go back and forth?
Interesting. And further than that, now back to the tools.
Okay. So going away from the questionnaire for a minute. So part of the tools are repair tools, and we've talked about one. We've talked about acknowledging harm done. And there's another part that I would call it's acknowledgement on behalf of appreciation. Giving credit where credit is due, really trying your best every day to just acknowledge, appreciate something. My rule of thumb in my house is if I didn't have to do it, I say thank you. Thanks for whether it's taking the trash, getting the groceries, doing this or that, because it helped me. So I try to be very generous with appreciation because it really is saying to the other person, I recognize you're making a contribution for me.
It's very funny because one of the things that they said in the recent research about saying appreciation is it's never to make it a general appreciation, but make it specific.
Yeah.
Thank you for taking out the garbage.
Yes.
Not just thank you for being. Because what people don't feel and what children often don't feel when you compliment them,
mm-hmm.
a child doesn't want to hear you're a wonderful little girl.
Yeah.
She wants to hear you're wonderful the way you did that painting. I like the photograph. It's something very specific.
Yes.
With mates, they want to know. They just don't want to hear words because the words just become words.
Yes.
And so it just becomes like you're pouring syrup over somebody. Sometimes instead to say to somebody, I really appreciate the way you set this table today. It's such a pretty thing. And to think that you put the time into setting this table so that we could have dinner together in this comfortable way touches my heart.
Mm-hmm.
Now
mm-hmm.
That's,
exactly.
That'll get to you.
Yep.
Yeah, well, this reminds me of another issue that I bring up all the time, and that is that most people have a tendency to think of therapy from a medical model, that they go in and that the doctor does something to them that changes the situation. Whereas I always try to point out that it's really you need an educational model, and that's what this is about. It's people educating their sense of what a relationship is and what the components are and how to conduct themselves positively in a relationship and to understand how they conduct themselves negatively. It's about information. Living well is a complicated skill.
You know, but my curiosity about that, Bill, and my to you as well, B,
mm-hmm.
couples therapy doesn't make any sense on 1 hour a week. It just doesn't make any sense. You got two people who are functioning with each other all the time. You know, if a couple really came into therapy, it would seem like what you'd want to do is have them in the room for 3 hours and then have them come back the next day for, you know, for further lessons and then 3 more hours and then send them off and say, okay, now come back in 2 days. Because 45 minutes once a week, what are you going to achieve in that time? You're going to hit some little spot and give them some little hint? Or you're going to give them your book, Try to See It My Way, you know, by Beehive, which is fine. But what could you do? The model of it seems wrong, Bill. You know what I mean? It seems like a ridiculous model, the once a week couples therapy. It's the one we use. We talk about them expecting medical model, but we use it.
Yeah, well, you know, it's the old thing. It's about individual therapy is the same way. Should it be total immersion? Should it be 3 weeks of intensives followed up by, you know, weekends for the next 6 months and so on? In a way, you could say, well, okay, that would probably be much more effective in the short term or in the time-limited sense. But people can't afford it.
Yeah, okay, so let's say that we got past the affording. People can't afford to lose as much as they lose in between. That it might be better off to just try to get people to come in 2 times or 3 times during 1 week and shorten the whole process.
I'm going to say I think there is absolute merit in what you're saying, Armand, but I also want to say that one of the benefits of having therapy happen over time is that therapy follows life. Life doesn't follow therapy. And so part of what you do need, and I do recommend when people are, like, in deep trouble that they come in more often. But if you're not in an absolute crisis, probably you've been doing these patterns for, like, you know, 10 years. And what part of what you need is to have it happen again, you know, that week, note it down. So I give people homework that they have to take home. Hi, I want you to write this down. I want you to take a look at what you've done. I want you to rethink this. And then I have them come in and say, what did you do? How did that work? You know, let's reinvent the wheel. So I think that there are some models. There certainly are some institutes where people do go away for three-day intensives or that sort of thing. And so I agree with you that it may not make sense in, you know, in some cases or maybe even in many cases.
You know what I like now? I think there's a new modern way.
What's that?
I've been doing consultations by Skype, S-K-Y-P-E.
Sure.
You know, you're right? So now I'm doing these face-to-face consultations. I could just imagine any day now you're going to be able to call up your therapist in the middle of the day. So maybe making the appointment may be tough, but your therapist could pop on the Skype line, and they could do it for like 20 minutes, 25 minutes, and you have a kind of a face-to-face or a three-way conversation. I think we have the modern tools to make things a little different so that when it gets heated, when you get to that point where you're really just damaging each other, you could call in the referee.
Yeah.
You know, and usually you call your therapist and your therapist calls you back 2 days later. And by then, you know, you've already damaged each other and wounded each other.
Right.
And forgotten what you did.
And forgotten what you did and forgotten why you even called in the first place.
Yep.
Be Janet Hibbs, so you're on the circuit now being interviewed by many people, usually not being interviewed by two shrinks, I'm sure.
Well, this is a treat.
Tell me what it's like. It's like most of the people are trying to ask you the definition of fairness, right?
I think most people don't have the same, certainly they don't have the clinical experience that the two of you have, so it's really interesting to hear the two of you talk about it from your clinical perspective. I think a lot of people either think, oh, yeah, we learned that in kindergarten, didn't we? This must be kind of one of those books about what you learned in kindergarten. So it's interesting trying to boil it down, you know, to have it accessible and help people understand, well, it's actually more complicated than what you learned in kindergarten. You know, you learned in kindergarten, don't hurt another person, but if it were that simple, there would never be a divorce.
Well, there's an issue that I'm really curious about, and I wanted to see your take on it. if you get into a relationship and you're in a relationship for 10 years, 15 years, somewhere along the line, you're going to go through changes, physical changes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be, you know, somebody is going to be going through menopause and whatever other changes of retirement. How do you factor in the menopausal factor into a relationship? I mean, nobody even talks about it. When you get married, they don't say, and you've got to know that this period is going to come when your windows are going to be open all day long, and, and you're going to be freezing your butt off. But nobody tells you about this. This is like something that hits men blindly, and they don't know what's going on, and the women don't know what's going on. It's almost like it's like an unconscious part of marriage. It's like nobody talks about it.
Okay, I think, I mean, part of what I would say to that is that, well, marriage, the deal changes all the time. Like, we have lots of different changes in circumstance. I mean, certainly menopause would be one of them that we could count on. I would say part of what helps people is just being able to talk about what's changing and talk about, you know, okay, how is this affecting you? How is it affecting me? Rather than just being annoyed with each other. So, I mean, part of what you have to pay attention to is what are the consequences? I care a lot about what are the consequences that, you know, this person's suffering or that person's suffering, because what you want to minimize are the interpersonal consequences.
Well, to me, this is a further extension of what I said about not expecting to get better at marriage and just accepting getting worse. This is where crisis is good, because it brings people to confront and deal with that they're not happy, that it's not working, and that they should do something positive about it and learn a new way.
Well, you know, I agree with you, Bill, because when it gets around a crisis, one of the things I've seen, for example, infidelity in a relationship, surviving infidelity in the long run leads to one of the deepest relationships. Surviving betrayal, surviving this kind of stuff, leads to something that doesn't mean, you know, once you go through the really rough, surviving illness is an amazing thing, because mm-hmm. it brings people to a level that the later years are very different than the earlier years of coupleship, you know, and the quality is so much better. Well, I want to thank my guest, B. Janet Hibbs, for being with us. Try to See It My Way is the name of the book, and the website is trytoseeitmyway.com. Janet, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. It was a treat.
Okay, it is my pleasure.
Thanks.
And Bill, I want to thank you for being here today. Thanks. Bill is the head of our Marriage and Family Counseling Division of the DeMel Center, and this is what he does. So thanks for joining me on this one, Bill.
It's a pleasure to join.
All right, my friends, we'll be back with you soon. If you want to get a copy of today, you can go to the website, thepositivemind.com.
But you're saying you can get it wrong and still think that it's all right. Think of what I'm saying. We can work it out and get it straight or say goodnight. We can work it out. We can work it out. Life is very short and there's no time for fussing and fighting, my friend.
Yes, we can. We can work it out. Haven't heard that in a long time. Armand DeMille, The Positive Mind. We can work it out right here at WBAI. I was at a meeting yesterday, and I got to tell you, we can work it out. We are going to work it out. We're talking with folks in the premium department, and many of us are going to work long and hard to get all the premiums, all the thank you gifts out to each and every one of you who spectacularly came through in fine fashion for us during this spring fundraising drive. Thank you so very much. Coming up next at 2 p.m., the Arts Magazine Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton at 3 p.m. The next meeting of the WBAI Local Station Board will take place on Wednesday, June 10th, 7 p.m. in the community room. You just turned off my Stevie. That's all right. It's gone now. In the community room at the at Cathedral Park Towers at 125 West 109th Street between Amsterdam and Columbus Avenues. That's between Amsterdam and Columbus Avenues. The location is wheelchair accessible. You can take the B or the C train to 110th Street. Again, Wednesday, June 10th, 7 p.m. at Cathedral Parkway Towers. And we apologize for such late notice and any inconvenience. Once again, this is 99.5 FM, WBAI, and WBAI.org. Again, thank you so very, very much for your intervention in our behalf, and in fact, in your own behalf, for supporting radio station WBAI. We're at 99.5 FM, and we're available online at WBAI.org.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! On June 12th at 7 p.m., join us for an evening with Noam Chomsky, Crisis and Hope, theirs and ours. Noam Chomsky comes to the historic Riverside Church in Harlem to address a wide range of issues, from the economic crisis to the war in the Middle East and South Asia to the election of Barack Obama. This talk is sponsored by the Brecht Forum and Riverside Church Ministries of Social Justice and Education. For more information and tickets, please contact 212-242-4201. That's 212-242-4201. Or go to www.brechtforum.org.
You are listening to WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, and on the internet at WBAI.org. This is Tuesday, and up next, the Tuesday Afternoon Arts Magazine.
Dear listeners, this is Indra Hardat. There's a great way to support your favorite community radio station, WBAI, and save on your taxes. You can donate your car, your truck, or your motorhome. We'll come pick up your vehicle for free and give you a receipt for your tax donation. It's easy. Just call our representative to find out if your vehicle qualifies at 866-WBAI-CAR. Again, that's 866-WBAI-CAR. Thank you for your continued support.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Arts Magazine. This is Prairie Miller, and on the show today, in the Arts Magazine screening room, the Human Rights Watch Film Festival, cultural philanthropy or promotional political propaganda for the corporations, an interview and commentary.
And my name is Peggy Dominique, and I have two gentlemen from the Lion's Brand Yarn Studio talking about a men's knitting night coming up in a few weeks.
And I'm Marianne Miller, and my guest this afternoon on the Arts Magazine will be Lorraine Leckie, no stranger to BAI listeners, straight from her hit at the Bowery Ballroom. And we'll hear about the solar energy project from Corinne Monaco.
First, a scene from The Age of Stupid, a film about the destruction of the environment, screening at New York's Human Rights Watch Film Festival.
Why are American cities designed so it's almost impossible not to have a car? Why were 100 railways in cities like New York, Philadelphia, and Los Angeles bought up and then deliberately destroyed? Why did the electric car get scrapped? Why were we, along with Australia, the only two countries not to sign the original Kyoto Climate?
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.